All right, good evening, everyone. Let's begin. So tonight begins, the truth is the series began last week, and I have good news and bad news. The good news is that the series continues this week.
Okay,
the bad news is that I'm giving it, as opposed to last week you had Rabbi Dr. Schachter.
Oh, but that's the bad news.
You know what they say, if you can't be with the one you love, then love the one you're with. We'll have to make do. I want to start by thanking Gary and Sherry Bauman for sponsoring this series in memory of Carl Bauman, Gary's father, Yehuda ben Baruch Zichron Livracha, and we hope that in the merit of our Talmud Torah's neshama will have an aliyah.
Amen.
So tonight's topic, this is a three-part series in total. Tonight's topic was supposed to be on the topic of relationships. The reason I say supposed to be on the topic of relationships is because as I sat down to begin to prepare this year, and the Rav writes extensively on relationships. In fact, excuse me, there is an entire book called Family Redeemed, which is all about the Rav's insights on family relationships, all different types of relationships, relationship between man and God, relationship between man and his fellow man, marriage, children, parents, friends. The Rav has it all. But then as I was sitting down and preparing it, I realized that I think we have to spend a little bit of time. When I say a little bit of time, I mean an entire shiur, really focusing on who was the Rav. In last week's shiur, Rabbi Schachter really gave us a beautiful panoramic view in terms of the three basic pillars that made up Rav Soloveitchik's personality. What I'd like to try to do tonight is kind of descend.
Halacha, and halacha.
Right, so we're going to come back to them actually in this week's shiur.
Okay.
What I'd like to try to do tonight is to really, the Rav, as we'll see, was a very complicated individual. And when I say, I don't mean complicated in a bad way. I mean, anytime you have a person who's profoundly thoughtful and a person who's incredibly intellectual, then by definition, they're just not a run-of-the-mill individual. So because of that, to understand what made the Rav tick, I'd like to be able tonight to focus a little bit on the biography of the Rav. But more importantly, what I'd like to focus on is some of the life experiences that forged the personality of Rav Yosef Dov HaLevi Soloveitchik, Zichron Livracha. So again, a little bit of biographical information. Rav Yosef Dov HaLevi Soloveitchik, who we'll refer to for the rest of the year as just simply the Rav, was born in Przyjana, Poland in 1903. Now, you have to understand also the family from which the Rav hailed from. The Rav's father was Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, who we'll discuss. His grandfather was a man by the name of Rav Chaim Brisker. Rav Chaim Brisker, or I should say Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, who was better known as Rav Chaim Brisker. His great-grandfather was Rav Yosef Dov HaLevi Soloveitchik. The Rav was named for his great-grandfather, a man also who's known by the title of his sefer, the Beis HaLevi. The Beis HaLevi. Again, so his father, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, grandfather, Rav Chaim Brisker, great-grandfather, the Beis HaLevi, Rav Yosef Dov HaLevi Soloveitchik, and his great-great-grandfather was a man by the name of Rav Chaim Valozhiner, also known as Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, Rav Chaim Valozhiner. Rav Chaim Valozhiner was the Talmid Mufam, the primary disciple of the Vilna Gaon. And the idea is he's called Rav Chaim Valozhiner because, again, Rav Chaim Valozhiner started Valozhin. Now, just a word about Valozhin. You know, you could go see Valozhin today. Valozhin still stands. Unfortunately, now the building is used as a post office. But the building itself still stands. Valozhin was known as the Eim HaYeshivos. It was known as the mother of all yeshivos. And the reason for that is because Rav Chaim Valozhiner was really the first to institute the concept of a yeshiva, where also the Talmidim's needs were cared for. This was an unheard of thing. Generally, a Talmud went to yeshiva. They had to, you know, anyone, you know, they had to go after teg, which refers to the process where they had to go ahead and get set up by families throughout the week for their meals. Rechaim Valozhner saw to the needs of his Talmidim as well. So this is Valozhner. So you understand the family from which the Rav hails from. The Rav's mother was a woman by the name of Pesha Feinstein. She was a daughter of Rav Elio Feinstein, who was the Rav of Prozhana, Poland. Now you understand why the Rav is from Prozhana, because after the Rav's parents married, after Rav Moshe Soloveitchik married Pesha Feinstein, they lived by the Feinsteins in Prozhana, Poland. That was the custom. Moshe Soloveitchik was supported by his in-laws, continued his learning, and they literally lived in his father-in-law's home. Rav Elio Feinstein, who's the Rav of Prozhana, was the uncle of Rav Moshe Feinstein, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. So the Rav and Rav Moshe were related. The Rav and Rav Moshe were related. Just you can imagine, these family trees are just off the charts in terms of individuals. Forget about intellect. Forget even, well, don't forget about intellect. But just the impact on the Jewish people that came out from. So you have the Soloveitchik family joining together with the Feinstein family through Rav Moshe Soloveitchik and Pesha Feinstein. And they have a son, Rav Soloveitchik, Rav Yosef Dov Halevi. Interestingly enough, the story is told that when Pesha Feinstein Soloveitchik gave birth to her first son, so Rav Moshe Soloveitchik came over to his daughter-in-law, and he said to her that no one was ever named for his grandfather. Like no one was actually saying, no one was ever named for his grandfather, the Beis Halevi. They said it was Yosef Dov. And interestingly enough, Rav Moshe, now remember, this was a big thing, because in general, right, Jewish practice has it that who gets naming rights for a first child? Mother. Mother usually has naming rights for the first child, right? So meaning father's family, people, mother gets the rights. So the story is told that Rav Moshe Soloveitchik went over to his daughter-in-law, and he said to her, if you name this boy after my grandfather, the Beis Halevi, Yosef Dov, I give you a haftacha, I give you a promise that he will grow up to be a great Talmud Chacham. Mm. So just an amazing, amazing story. Okay, at this point in time, so I'm only giving you the panoramic view. I'm giving you the cliff notes. After this point, after the Rav is born, they spend a couple of years in Prozhana. The Rav's family moves to Chaslovich. Chaslovich was in White Russia. Why did they move to Chaslovich? Because Rav Moshe Soloveitchik was asked to be the Rav of the city. So the entire family moves to White Russia. In 1920, this was a major pivotal event in the Rav's life. The family leaves Chaslovich. We'll talk about Chaslovich in just a little bit. The Rav's family leaves Chaslovich and they relocate to Warsaw. Why Warsaw? Because Rav Moshe Soloveitchik is asked to head up the Talmud department in the Tach Kimoni Rabbinical Seminary. Now, Tach Kimoni is a discussion by itself. Tach Kimoni, you know, the Rav is famous for Torah Umada, even though the Rav never said the words Torah Umada. He never actually said those words, but the Rav articulated the concept. The Rav had exposure to this concept. Tach Kimoni Institute, a rabbinical institute, was such a type of an institute where there was a combination of Torah as well as other studies there to create a different type of rabbinical leader for the new age. So 1920, the family moves to Warsaw. This is very big because you can imagine, well, you can't imagine. Chaslovich, I'm trying to think of a good common day example. Chaslovich is like the Sticks, yeah. Have to be careful, you know. For people from New York, Baltimore is also the Sticks, you know. All right. So it's mamish like out of town. You know, it's like going to Boise, Idaho. Like, there's nothing. Warsaw was a major city and also a major Jewish metropolis, a major hub of Jewish activity. Here, the Rav is exposed to many different personalities. So 1920, again, the Rav, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik sets his position. In 1929, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik is just making sure we're good here on our. Okay. 1929, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik is invited by the president of Ritz, Rav Yitzchok Elchanan Theological Seminary, to assume the position as Rosh Yeshiva. This is 1929. Rav Moshe Soloveitchik goes. But the Rav stays behind. At this point in time, the Rav does not join his family. So Moshe Soloveitchik goes to the United States in 1929. At this point in time, the Rav, now having really spent a couple of years in Warsaw, at first attends the Free Polish University It's not the University of Polish that was free. It was literally called the Free Polish University. And then ultimately the Rav transfers to University of Berlin. In 1931, the Rav marries his wife, Tanya Lewitt. And in 1932, the Rav, his wife, and one child who was already born emigrate to the United States. When the Rav comes to the United States, and again, I'm giving you all of this just by way of introduction. We'll touch on some of it in our various shiurim. When the Rav comes to the United States, it's actually interesting. So, as you know, again, 1932, so interestingly enough, the Rav's visa, this is actually quite fascinating, you can actually see these documents. The Rav's visa, you know, to come to this country, I don't know, there's something going on with the computer. Okay. Anyway, you have to have a sponsor. So who sponsored the Rav? Who sponsored Rav Soloveitchik? The Hebrew Theological Seminary in Skokie. So the Hebrew Theological Seminary in Skokie went ahead and it sponsored the Rav to come over. But it's interesting, there's a telegram that you can actually access all of these documents. There's a telegram that the Hebrew Theological Seminary sent to Reitz saying, you know, we sponsored Rabbi Soloveitchik, a great Talmud Chacham. We have no money to pay him. In a position, you need to find him something on the Eastern Seaboard. Amazing. So what happens? So the Rav is invited to become the head of the Vad Ha'ir in Boston. So the Vad Ha'ir in Boston was essentially a conglomerate of the rabbinic organizations. They oversaw shuls, oversaw Chevra Kadisha, oversaw Kashrus. The Rav is invited to become head of the Vad Ha'ir, and the Rav accepts that position. The Rav very quickly learns that America is not Europe. One of the first things that the Rav gets involved with, and again, it's important to highlight this episode because it has a dramatic effect on the Rav's life. The Rav realized that the shochtim, the ritual slaughterers, were being exploited. They were being worked too many hours by the owners, Jewish owners of the slaughterhouses, and they were being paid too little money. So the Rav started a crusade for the rights of the shochtim. The slaughterhouse owners did not like this. And they reported Rabbi Soloveitchik to the IRS for tax evasion. The Rav was locked into a major legal battle for years, for up to 3 years. And what was amazing is I didn't put it on the sheet because we'll deal with it differently. You could read the judgment. Of course, the Rav was found. Interesting enough, the result was the Rav had overpaid on his taxes each year. But what was the incredible Chilul Hashem is that the non-Jewish judge who oversaw the proceedings blasted the Jewish community for being so corrupt in their practices and essentially trying to vilify such a righteous, upstanding individual. The reason why this is a very important episode in the Rav's life is because this, in the realm of communal affairs, this left a very bad taste in the Rav's mouth. Which is one of the reasons why, interestingly enough, Rabbi Soloveitchik is probably, I think, one of the most misquoted, misused rabbinic personalities of our century. So how does something like that happen? It happens when you don't make declarative statements. It happens when you don't take public stance on certain things. It happens when you don't commit everything to writing. What the Rav is very reticent, we'll see it in some of his writings, to often take certain stands because of this particular event. This ultimately leads the Rav to really to a certain degree recede, take a step back from communal affairs, and really plant himself being Kosei Beis HaMedrash, to really put himself in the Olam HaYeshiva, in the world of the Yeshiva, and to become, again, a great Torah luminary. 1937, the Rav founds the Maimonides School, which is the first Jewish day school in New England. In 1941, January 31st, 1941, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik passes away. And at this point in time, the Rosh Yeshiva position of Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Theological Seminary, Reitz, which is the rabbinical school, is now vacant. Amazingly enough, if you take a look at number one, this is quite amazing. So this is from, we're going to quote from a number of different books tonight. But one of them, and the truth is, they're all excellent reading. This is a book called The Soloveitchik Heritage, written by Shulamis Soloveitchik Meiselman, one of the daughters of the Rav. So this was in the Rav's hesped, in the Rav's eulogy that he gave for his father, he said these words. Since the age of prophecy is over, and since the prophets handed their mantle to the men of the great assembly to continue the teaching of our Torah, our tree of life, this mantle has become the possession of the great Torah leaders, and they teach it to their students. My father received the mantle from the great Torah sage Reb Chaim, who in turn received it from Rav Yoshe Ber, the Beis Halevi, the Rav's namesake, going back to Rav Chaim Valashin. I accept the mantle of Torah and will continue in the tradition of my family to spread Torah to whoever is eager to learn the ways of our tree of life. This is what the Rav says in his eulogy for his father, the Rav accepting the position of Rosh HaYeshiva of Ritz. Interestingly enough, you know, we always say the Klal Gadol is great people become great
when they're dead.
Yeah. So amazingly enough, there was incredible opposition to appointing the Rav as Rosh Yeshiva in Ritz for a variety of reasons. People thought he was too young. People thought he was too inexperienced. So amazingly enough, we have, you know, the Yeshiva Yerushalayim has all these things in archives. So in the Rav's first contract as Rosh Yeshiva, they offered him a one-year contract. Mm-hmm. A one-year contract. And it's stipulated in the one-year contract that over the course of the year, he will have to prove his usefulness to Yeshivas Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan Theological Seminary. Amazing. Absolutely amazing. Amazing. It makes our, I mean, you know, no matter how much we think, you know, the shul is the Wild West and things go on, you know, when you hear stuff like this, it sounds totally out of the ballpark. So they give him a one-year contract. Suffice it to say, I don't know if it was ever officially renewed, but the Rav, of course, spends the rest of his time as the Rosh HaYeshiva in Yeshiva University, and the Rav passes away on April 18th, 1993, Chol HaMoed Pesach. So as I started this year, a couple of minutes ago, so the topic for tonight was supposed to be relationships, and as I began to sit down and compile the various sources for the Rav's incredible insights on relationships, it dawned on me that to really appreciate the words of the Rav, so we have to understand who the man was. And again, Rabbi Schachter did a masterful job laying that groundwork. And the truth is, all I really want to do is build on the foundation that he built for us last week. I think if I had to summarize it in one sentence, we would say, the Rav was a man of contradictions. The Rav was a man of conflicting personality traits. Now, there are some people that you could easily define them. You could sum up their essence, their gestalt, their mahos, what they are. You could say, this person stands for this. If you try to summarize the Rav in one sentence, two sentences, three sentences, it's difficult because the Rav himself seems to be conflicted about who he is. And I want to share with you just a couple of examples of this conflict, this inner turmoil. Now, again, the one incredible thing about the Rav that we'll see is, you know, when we think about turmoil, if I say turmoil, you think about, let's do some word association. I say turmoil, you say?
Riots.
Riots,
no,
okay.
No.
Guy, his violent streak is coming out. Good. What else?
Anxiety.
Right. Anxiety.
Emotional.
Okay, so, okay, I would say, I'm going to, all right, we'll end the interactive part this year.
Right,
I would say turmoil, resolution.
Ah.
Turmoil, resolution, right? State of turmoil, you want to resolve the turmoil. So what's interesting that we'll see from the Rav is not every state of turmoil requires resolution. There are some states of turmoil that are actually good turmoil. There's some friction that's positive friction. And that's why the amazing part about the Rav is the Rav didn't feel the need to reconcile some of this inner turmoil. But yet, as we can imagine, to live with turmoil is not a pasha thing. It's not simple. So I want to show you some examples of this inner turmoil, this inner conflict. Take a look at number two. Again, there's a lot more than what we're going to do tonight. And I made a large packet for you because the truth is you'll see the reading is incredible. We're not going to do everything tonight, but take a look at number two. So this is from, I'm also trying to give you just a sampling of some of the Rav's major works. So Lonely Man of Faith. So the Rav writes over here, this is from right the opening page of Lonely Man of Faith. The Rav writes, the nature of the dilemma. Now, when he says the dilemma, what is he referring to?
Man.
He refers to the existential dilemma of man. If you want to know what is the essence of the dilemma of the human condition, he says very simply, can be stated in a three-word sentence. I am lonely. Let me emphasize, however, that by stating I am lonely, I do not intend to convey to you the impression that I am alone.
Mm-hmm.
I thank God to enjoy the love, friendship of many. I meet people, talk, preach, argue, reason. I am surrounded by comrades and acquaintances, and yet companionship and friendship do not alleviate the passional experience of loneliness, which trails me constantly. I am lonely because at times I feel rejected and thrust away by everybody, not excluding my most intimate friends. And the words of the psalmist, my mother and father have forsaken me. Ki avi v'imi va'azavuni, ring quite often in my ears, like the plaintive cooing of the turtle dove. It is a strange, alas, absurd experience engendering sharp, enervating pain, as well as a stimulating, cathartic feeling. I despair because I am lonely and hence feels frustrated. On the other hand, I also feel invigorated because this very experience of loneliness presses everything in me into the service of God. So here's a perfect example. So right, the Rav says, I'm lonely, but yet what? But yet what? I'm not alone. So again, we're not going to get into this, but the Rav develops this incredible idea of loneliness versus aloneness. This is not our topic for tonight, but again, just give you an insight into the turmoil that rages inside the Rav. I'm connected to so many. The Rav was a Rebbe to thousands. The Rav had the greatest impact, I would say, on Orthodox Judaism in our entire, in this century. The Rav, you know how you know the greatness of the Rav? Is that the Rav is still a Rebbe to this very day. I always say something that's fascinating about the Rav is whenever you quote someone who's passed away, right? So we always say Zecher Tzadik Livracha. What's amazing is more often than not, when the Rav is quoted, for some reason, I don't know why this is, he often doesn't get the Zecher Tzadik Livracha. I think that's because the Rav's teachings are so alive, not only for his Talmidim, but even for the students of his Talmidim. So here you have a man who's the antithesis of alone. He is forever now part of the Mesorah, and yet he's saying, I can't explain it. I know it doesn't make sense. I'm surrounded by people. But yet sometimes it's when I'm surrounded by those very people that what? That I feel fundamentally rejected and alone. Ki aviv v'imi azavuni. I even feel forsaken even by those who are closest to me. Take a look at number three. Let me give you another example of turmoil. In halachic man. So in halachic man, the Rav writes by, and this Rabbi Schachter spent a significant amount of time and developed so beautifully last week. But the Rav writes, when halachic man approaches reality, he comes with his Torah given to him from Sinai in hand. He orients himself to the world by means of fixed statutes and firm principles. An entire corpus of precepts and laws guides him along the path leading to existence. Halachic man, well furnished with rules, judgments, and fundamental principles, draws near the world with a priori relation. Now, a priori relation, I had to look this up. A priori means relating to or derived by reasoning from self-evident propositions. This is what Rabbi Schachter discussed last week, which is that halachic man does not allow the world to create his realities, but halachic man imposes realities upon his world. Halacha creates a reality, and that's the reality that I superimpose upon my existence. He says, his approach begins with an ideal creation and concludes with a real one. To whom may he be compared? So listen to this comparison. To a mathematician who fashions an ideal world and then uses it for the purpose of establishing a relationship between it and the real world, as was explained above. The essence of the halacha, which was received from God, consists in creating an ideal world and cognizing the relationship between the ideal world and our concrete environment. Exactly the same idea that halacha creates our reality. We see the world through the prism of halacha. I don't allow what I observe to forge my reality, but rather it's what I believe and what I know creates my reality. So on one hand, you read this and you say, the Rav is clearly a man who focuses just on halachic norms, who uses the intellect not only to see the world, but the intellect to forge a meaningful relationship with God and surroundings. Yet look at number four. This is from a wonderful, wonderful sefer, wonderful book called Worship of the Heart, which are the Rav's essays, the Rav's thoughts on prayer. So in this, the Rav has an incredible essay where he writes about the five mediums, the five different ways in which man has the ability to connect with God. So one of them is called the emotional medium. So look what the Rav writes here. He says, man is also able to approach God through his great, passionate love for him, through an ecstatic experience which enables the finite being to transcend the bonds of finitude, to rise above the limited and relative to the height of absoluteness and endlessness. Man, many Jewish philosophers and mystics maintained, may reach God not only through the intellect, but also through the heart, through a pure and serene mind, however naive and simple, through a passionate, sincere, though not intellectually enlightened love, through craving for God, even when the heart which craves has not been illumined by divine knowledge and wisdom, in loneliness and despair, even if the lonely and despairing soul cannot interpret its own misery, or through joy and jubilation, notwithstanding the fact that the heart which is filled with gratitude and happiness is too ignorant to analyze its aroused emotion. One may find access to God in ignorance and intellectual want, as long as he is truthful and his feelings are sincere and genuine. So what is Rav saying over here? That man could approach God even if what? Even if he's not the halachic man. Even if he does not go ahead and see the world through the constructs of halacha, even if he does not see reality through the intellectual medium, man could go ahead and connect with HaKadosh Baruch Hu even in a profound sense of ignorance.
The Vilna Gaon,
but the Baal Shem Tov is a different parasha.
But it's also
correct. The concept itself is not a chiddush. What I'm trying to point out over here is the Rav's contradicting himself. That's what I'm trying to point out over here. In halachic man, the Rav clearly says that the way you see the world and the way you see God is through the construct of halacha, which means that the only way to have the religious experience is through the intellect. Here, one source later, the Rav is saying a person could live in total ignorance and have him, the Rav's not advocating for that, obviously, but nevertheless, a person can be in total ignorance and yet have this passionate connection with God. Turn to paragraph C for just a moment. This, I think, is one of the most beautiful, beautiful lines. The Rav says, a person, even in ignorance, can feel the feeling of his presence, companionship, and closeness is vivid and overpowering. Listen to these words. One feels the breath of infinity in the stillness of a clear starlit night when he simply perceives the great miracle of being in touch with the Creator who resides beyond the endless spaces of the flying nebula. It's poetry, right? So the Rav says that what? That as long as you're a tamimus person, as long as you are sincere in your desire to connect with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, then guess what? When you stand outside at night and gaze up into the beautiful heavens and are just mesmerized by the stars and the planets of the beauty of creation, guess what, says the Rav? You too could connect in a passionate and meaningful way with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So on one hand, the Rav, halachic man, says everything must be viewed through the prism of halach, through the prism of intellect. And yet here the Rav says, but there's an emotional medium in which man, as long as he's sincere, can connect with God even through profound ignorance. Take a look at number 5. Now, I think in order to understand, you know, of course, I think we'd all agree that if you want to really understand the person, so how do you really understand the person? What do you look at? You look at their family, right? You look at their family, right? Where did they come from? Because the truth is, all of us, both, you know, for good and for not so good, right? We assimilate things that we learned growing up. So now hopefully, what if, and there are many more examples, but I'm just trying to illustrate a point that the Rav is a man in turmoil. The Rav is a man of conflicting and almost contradictory ideas and ideals. And now I want to show you that the truth is part of this has to do with the fact that we'll see this was embedded in the Rav's very upbringing. Take a look at number 5. So I'm going to quote to you now from a number of sections from a book, a two-volume series called The Rav. The Rav was written, two-volume series written by Rav Aaron Rakefet.
Ah, yes.
And it's an excellent two-volume series. The truth is, there are many. It's not an intellectual work. Meaning, you're not going to find fascinating ideas, deep and profound ideas by the Rav. Yeah. What Rav Rakefet does is he really compiles stories, anecdotes, a lot of biographical information. So we'll see some incredible things about it. We're not going to read all of this, but look at number 5. So here, Rakefet, and again, he quotes over this related by the Rav in his annual shir in memory of his father, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, on January 29th, 1952. And in this drasha, the Rav contrasts his two grandfathers, Right? Remember, one grandfather, we said, was Rav Elio Feinstein, the Rav of Pruzhana, Poland. And his other grandfather was Rav Chaim Brisker. So now he wants to go ahead and compare his two grandfathers. So listen to this. So the Rav writes, he says, I refer to my two grandfathers, my grandfather on my mother's side, Rav Elio Feinstein of Pruzhana, and my grandfather on my father's side, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik of Brisk. Both were great Torah personalities and saintly personalities, but they were very different from each other in a unique way. Paragraph B. Rav Elio Prozhaner entered the rabbinate at the age of 16. Now you understand what that means. He became a Rav. He went into a leadership position at the age of 16. He remained a spiritual leader until his death at the age of 86, devoting 70 years to the rabbinate. His character exemplified piety and abstinence. He was always dressed in rabbinic clothing. No one ever saw him in short clothing, i.e. modern clothing. This is short clothing, right? So no one ever saw, when he says rabbinic clothing, meaning the rabbis would wear a frock, right? Mm-hmm. A long black coat. So Elio Prozhaner never wore modern clothing, always wore a rabbinic frock. Whether it was hot or cold, he always wore the long frock that characterized the traditional rabbi. He never walked quickly. His pace was always dignified. No one ever saw him roar in laughter, and he never spoke at length or had frivolous conversations with people on the street. His words were very few, and his every action was weighed. My grandfather would rise with the sun every day in order to learn and pray the morning prayers at the earliest hour. Never did he show excitement, and never did he show emotion. You could never tell whether he was sad or whether he was happy. My grandfather was never too close or too distant from anyone. In a word, he was a total representative of the golden path. His deportment totally radiated dignity. The golden path, referring to the Maimonidean concept of the Derech HaMamutza, the middle path. So Rav Elio Prozhaner, Rav Elio Feinstein was the model of rabbinic restraint and poise. Everything was ordered. Everything was like with laser-like precision. Got up, davened, walked a certain way, interacted a certain way, dressed a certain way, conducted himself a certain way. This next paragraph, I'm telling you, is going to blow you away. Because the truth is, when we think about some of these personalities, we have a very different... Listen, look at letter C. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik of Brisk. Now, this is Rav Chaim Brisker. Rav Chaim Brisker, one of the greatest Torah minds of his generation. My other grandfather was exactly the opposite. Even though he was the greatest intellect of his generation, he was filled with emotion and sensitivity. At times he would be happy and overjoyed, and at times he would be sad and haunted with melancholy thoughts. Mm-hmm. Sometimes he would bitterly fight with the strength of a cedar tree, and other times he would be as soft as a reed. Rav Chaim was a person of conflicting emotions and inner contradictions. Throughout his life, he never maintained a set schedule. He never ate at the same time. He never prayed at the same time. Every day he had to take care to make sure that he recited the Shema at the proper time. Rav Chaim never dressed like a rabbi. Now, he wasn't wearing jeans and a t-shirt. What it means is he dressed like a modern person, I guess. He didn't wear the traditional rabbinic frock. Paragraph D. When he traveled by train, no one recognized him as Rav Chaim of Brisk. When he recited the Shmona Esrei, he would be one of the first to finish and would wait for its repetition by the reader. He would always greet people first and would always be first to bless his fellow Jews with the Shabbos greetings. Watch paragraph E. Many times you would find Rav Chaim surrounded by a group of young children at play. He acted as the horse for them on the floor. The children would grab and pull his frock and cry out to him, "Giddy up, forward." At all times, anyone could freely approach him because he was very democratic. One cannot say that he was a well-organized person, because he did not function in a harmonious, calculated, disciplined, and coordinated fashion. He developed his unique and genius intellect by himself, with almost no help from rabbis or teachers. Through his own abilities, he was responsible for a revolutionary halachic methodology. His warm and open heart was developed because of his intense desire to possess such traits. My late father told me that Reb Chaim once told him, Moshe is Reb Moshe Soloveitchik, the son of Reb Chaim Brisker, the father of the Rav, "Do not think that I am inherently good. My character is actually bad. One has to force oneself to develop..." I'm sorry, I got it cut off. He goes on to say, one has to force oneself to develop one's traits into being a good person. So you see over here from the beginning, the Rav in his grandfathers, and you know, we think about Reb Chaim Brisker. Reb Chaim Brisker, who would think he's on the floor playing giddy up with the kids, right? But here you see, the reason I'm sharing this with you, besides the fact that it's fascinating, is because all of us, our personalities are forged by the familial influences we have in our youth. See, here the Rav, even from his youth, sees two grandfathers that are radical opposites, both brilliant Torah geniuses. Rav Elia Prajaner, really the embodiment, the epitome of rabbinic poise and restraint. Rav Chaim Brisker almost seems like a mad genius, right? He's right, sweet, outgoing, right? He's all over, everybody could approach him, the kids are playing with him, he's kind, he's the first to greet everybody, good Shabbos, brilliant genius, not davening at the same time, not eating at the same time. This is what the Rav sees. Look at number 6. I want to show you a couple of more ideas. Mm-hmm. When it came to matters of faith, this is the Rav in his eulogy for Rav Chaim Heller. Now, the truth is, the Rav's relationship with Rav Chaim Heller that began in the Rav's days in Warsaw was a major relationship for the Rav, which we're not going to get into today. In our session next week, we'll speak a little about. The truth is, I realized afterwards, as I was preparing this shiur for today, so after I stopped preparing the original shiur, and began to prepare the new shiur, I realized that we really could have done a 3-part series just on the biography of the Rav, because the Rav had so many fascinating relationships. We could do a shiur on his relationship with Rav Chaim Heller. We could do another shiur on his relationship with the Lubavitcher Rebbe and Rav Moshe Feinstein. Right? You understand that there was this generation where all three of these great men, right, walked on the soil of this country. Or the Lubavitcher Rebbe. Again, he overlapped with the Lubavitcher Rebbe, also University of Berlin. So they had a relationship. Okay, but we'll stick to this for tonight. So he says, and here, look what the Rav writes here. When it comes to, this is not the Rav, remember, Rav Rakefa transcribed things that the Rav said. One thing you have to understand about the Rav also, and this is quite interesting, the Rav always spoke from notes. The Rav did not speak extemporaneously. It's said that when the Rav would always go around to the classes in Maimonides on Erev Shabbos to go ahead and give Divrei Torah, even to the younger classes. So they say that even when the Rav would go into the nursery in the first grade, he would take out note cards and he would put it on. But this was the Rav. The Rav was organized. The Rav was methodical to get up. Now, what's even more amazing is sometimes when you speak from notes, you know, speakers often find that there's a trade-off between, on one hand, being very well organized, but sometimes you lose some of the passion in notes versus, not that we're speaking from notes, having more passion, but sometimes running the risk of, well, sometimes going a little too long, which could happen even to the best of us, right? And sometimes going off topic. So what's amazing is somehow the Rav kept up, you know, when the Rav gave his Yahrzeit shiur, the Yahrzeit shiur would go on sometimes for 2, 3, 4 hours, and people just sat, and not sat and slept, sat and paid attention, drinking every single word. It's amazing. So this is again in the Rav's eulogy from Chaim Heller. He writes, when it came to matters of faith and belief in God, the giants of Torah knowledge and the rabbinic leaders of the Jewish people became like little children. They approached these subjects with all the innocent simplicity and charm of unsophisticated youngsters. Their religious experiences were total and satiated with fervor. Whenever you took cognizance of their greatness, you also perceived their youthful exuberance. Look what the Rav writes about his grandfather. Who was my grandfather? Rav Chaim Brisk. On one hand, he was a master of abstract thought who introduced basic changes in Talmudic methodology and analysis. This was the mature Rav Chaim. Excuse me. Thank you. On the other hand, he was like a simple, tender child who cannot control his intense emotions and his yearnings for the sublime, refined realization of his dreams and expectations. Look at paragraph D. The mature Reb Chaim totally disciplined his intellect, and his incisive logic redefined the rich world of halacha in precise terminology and razor-sharp distinctions. This same person would also be completely swept away by an outflow of simple emotional faith, which flowed in often confusing directions to hidden spiritual and mystical realms. This was the characteristic of Reb Chaim when he functioned as a mere child, Who was my late father, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, my teacher, if not simultaneously both a great scholar and a tender child? Thank you very much. Excuse me. Who was my late father, if not simultaneously both a great scholar and a tender child, both exacting intellectual brilliance and emotional simplicity merged in his personality? So the Rav sees something amazing, and he perceives it already in his youth, that here are these men of incredible towering stature and intellect, and yet what? In certain respects, they're childlike. They're childlike in their excitement. They're childlike in their connection with God. So you see, again, you understand why I'm doing this. I'm just showing you where the Rav's good turmoil comes from, because he's being brought up in an atmosphere of incredible, towering, overpowering, immeasurable intellect that is laced with beautiful, almost volcanic-like emotion. Take a look at number 7. I want to show you another example of this. And this I think, is so beautiful. The Rav spoke about his great-grandfather. Remember, the Rav was named for his great-grandfather, the Beis Halevi, Rav Yosef Halevi Soloveitchik. Listen to this story. When in Warsaw, he decided to visit Rav Yaakov Gesundheit. So now this is the Beis Halevi going to visit Rav Yaakov Gesundheit, the community's Rav. He was the Rav of Warsaw. Listen to this story. They were seated in the living room, and suddenly they heard the Jewish maid in the kitchen start to sing. Reb Yankala, right, the Rav of Warsaw, immediately stood up and angrily walked in the direction of the kitchen to stop the maid's singing. There's a concept of kalisha, right, the Shulchan Aruch brings down, that a man, a Jewish man, is not permitted to hear a Jewish woman singing, assuming she's not related to him. So Reb Yankala, right, the Rav of Warsaw gets up, and he's about to storm towards the kitchen to tell the maid to stop singing. Watch this. Rav Yosef Ber, the Beis Halevi, the Rav's great-grandfather, also rose and pulled his host aside. The rabbi of Warsaw asked the Beis Halevi why he had stopped him. "I will explain my actions," said Rav Yosef Ber, the Beis Halevi. "Your maid works hard. The only enjoyment and pleasure she has is singing. It is true that we are enjoined from listening to her singing, but we can step outside or go into a different room. However, you want her to stop singing? That's not fair. It's her only enjoyment." So here you see just an incredible, incredible idea. That here the Rav sees again, and this is what makes the Rav so incredibly magnificent, which is this fidelity to halacha, this unswerving commitment to the tenets of the law, but yet what? A recognition that never use halacha to compromise the humanity or the dignity of another. You're right. We can't hear her singing, but we don't have to tell her to stop. We can just remove ourselves from the situation. Let her have the simcha. Why does our need to satisfy our halachic mandate have to go ahead and trample and take away from someone else? Let's find a way to go ahead and live together. We'll get our halacha, she'll continue her singing. So this is what the Rav grows up on. Take a look at number 8. This is an amazing idea as well. We're not going to do this entire piece. But the Rav writes again, this is again from Rav Rakepet, number 8. This is such a beautiful insight. "In my youth, I asked my father, Rav Moshe, why the sages left so many questions unresolved and simply ended the Talmudic discussion with teku." Sometimes in this discussion in the Talmud, the discussion ends with the word teku. Teku is tav, yud, kuf, vav. What does teku mean? Teku is an acronym for Tishbi Yitaretz Krushios V'Ibayos. That there are some questions that the Talmud does not know how to solve. So Talmud essentially says, it's okay. When Eliyahu HaNavi, when the prophet Elijah comes, one of the things that he's going to do is he's going to clear up all of the ambiguities in halacha. Sometimes the Gemara just says teku. So the Rav says, "I once asked my father, why are there so many tekus?" Now, you have what is the Rav really asking? What the Rav is asking his father is, "Father, there is nothing more powerful in this world than the human intellect. Why couldn't the rabbis in the Gemara resolve it? Why couldn't they push forward on and on and on until they got a resolution?" And listen to what Rav Moshe Soloveitchik answered his son. "My father answered me by asking why there were chukim." So Rav Moshe answers with the question. Well, right, little Rav Yosef, though, little Rav Yosheber. So why are there chukim? Why are they? Remember, chukim refers to mitzvos for which there does not appear to be an understandable reason. He explained, so this is Ramosha Soloveitchik talking, he explained that God wished to teach us that not every event and happening can be comprehended by the limited mortal mind. Just as the Torah remains our eternal document, even with the chukim, similarly a Jew must continue his eternal march before the Almighty, even though at times he does not comprehend the events that transpire around him. Likewise, my father held that the rabbis instituted the concept of teiku, so that a Jew would understand that his faith must remain complete even when there are unresolved questions and events in his life. So this is absolutely amazing. So Moshe Soloveitchik tells his son something fascinating. Could the rabbis have resolved the issues in the Talmud? Could they have done it? Yes. But the rabbis purposely left certain things unresolved. Why? To teach us that we have to learn to have faith even in the face of doubt. Now, what's amazing is now the Rav goes on to explain this idea. He goes into incredible depth. He tells a story in paragraph E. And in paragraph D, he discusses the idea that Rebbe Shaffer spoke about as well. This idea how, let's say, if a person is in mourning and then Yom Tov comes, then what happens? The Yom Tov truncates the Shiva, concludes the Shiva, and a person has to go ahead and quite literally put all of their mourning practices aside, and a person, mamish, has to celebrate Yom Tov. A person has to leave a simcha. So the Rav says, but yet again, it's difficult. It's hard. I have to shelve my emotions. So the Rav says, the soul must do, because this is the halacha. This is the lesson of teiku and chukim. We must break down our emotions and surrender to the divine will. The concept of teiku means that sometimes, even if I don't understand it, I still have to what? I still have to do it. And he tells an amazing story here. In paragraphs E, F, and G, he tells a story that happened in the Yeshiva of Aloshin. So the story was told that on the first night of Shavuos, so the students had come back after dinner. They came into the Beis Medrash. Here, look, paragraph E. The building was aglow with illumination and spiritual fervor. Some 400 students were engrossed in Talmudic study. Suddenly, the fatherly figure, the Netziv, Rav Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, the Rosh HaYeshiva Aloshin, appeared in the Beis Medrash. In a loud voice, he declared, "Let us join together in a dance in honor of the Almighty's giving us the Torah." And they began to dance on Shavuos night in Valoshin. The Rav goes on to explain that in the middle of the dancing, a telegraph came, and the non-Jewish messenger opened it up for the Netziv. The Netziv looked at the telegram, put it back in the envelope, put it in his pocket. After Shavuos was over, the Netziv took off his shoes and began to cry bitterly. The telegram that he received on the first night of Yom Tov had told him that his one and only sibling, his only sister, had passed away. But the Netziv did not exhibit any display of mourning on Yom Tov. He kept his emotions in check until Yom Tov was over, and only once Yom Tov was over did he allow himself to descend into his avelos. And these are the examples that the Rav sees. There are two things that come out from this. Number one, that although the whole salvation, the whole Brisker dynasty, is built on the strength of the intellect, man must accept the reality that intellect has its limitations. Intellect has its limitations, right? There's a takeaway in life. There are things we can't answer. There are situations we can't resolve. There are certain things that we just have to accept as they are, and we have to accept the will of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, even if we don't like it. That's just the way it is. But amazingly enough, even though intellect is limited, intellect must also be the guiding light of emotion. Man can never let his emotion run his life, because emotions can be deceiving. Emotions could be derailing. Man has to live his life through his intellect. Just like the Netziv, the halacha says, I can't mourn, so therefore I don't permit myself to mourn. There is no emotional display. He continued dancing. Yom Tov's over. Now I have the halachic license, the intellectual license to mourn. That's when mourning begins. So you see, again, on one hand, the dynasty that's built on the intellect acknowledges the limitations of the intellect, while at the same time saying that it is that very intellect that must still go ahead and drive emotions. Let me show you one last thing. And I think with this, we're not going to get to everything tonight. So with this, we'll have to conclude.
So what are we doing next week?
Let me finish first. So I want to say something amazing. Number nine, again from Rav Akiva, and this is very, very important in understanding the Rav. Because there's one thing that the Rav did that the Soloveitchik dynasty before him never did. And that was, the Rav spoke about feelings. This, remember, as much as we saw the Rav described his father, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, as this very emotional being, the Rav talks about when he took leave of his father from Warsaw, when the Rav was going. So the Rav writes that his father never told him that he loved him, but the Rav knew that his father loved him. He said that when they parted ways, right, when Moshe Soloveitchik was going to America, the Rav was going up to university, they shook hands. They shook hands. That's what they did. In the Soloveitchik home, emotion was not displayed not because they were cold, not because they didn't love each other. Because again, as we just saw before, the Soloveitchik dynasty was built on a cultivation of the intellect. Right? Emotion is problematic. Emotion sometimes erodes. The emotion is there, but to manifest it, to display it, is not always the best thing. The feelings are there. It's just the display is not. What really makes the Rav stand apart from his father, and maybe a little bit less from his grandfather, as I'm just going to leave it there, as the grandfather, as we've seen already, Rav Chaim Brisk was apparently a little bit different, is the emotion. The Rav writes about feelings. The Rav writes about the Rav writes about love. The Rav writes about romance. The Rav writes about loss. The Rav writes about belonging and feelings. So where does this come from? Take a look at number nine. And this is very important for understanding the Rav, and with this we'll close out tonight. I heard the following from my father in the name of my grandfather, Reb Chaim. As you know, Reb Chaim was not a chassid, although he was closer to Hasidic thought than most people would imagine. Now we can actually appreciate that statement based on the Rav's description of Reb Chaim Brisker before. Reb Chaim stated about a certain Hasidic Rebbe that when he recited a blessing, those listening would cry because of the emotional experience. This was the heart of Hasidus, to teach a Jew how to properly recite a blessing. What the Rav is contrasting is Hasidus with, let's say, the Brisker approach. The Brisker approach is to try to understand the halachic norms. This is the halachic man that forged man's understanding of the universe. What's Hasidus? Hasidus is to get man to feel. To get man to feel, to get man to go ahead and experience even just the smallest act of spiritual activity in a profound way. What do I know about Chabad? I know quite a bit. Listen to this. Since as a child, I had a malamid who was a Chabad chassid. Instead of teaching me Gemara, he taught me Chassidus. Even today, I still know sections of the Tanya by heart, especially the Shara Yichud v'Ha'emunah, dealing with faith and attributes of the Almighty. It was my father who taught me Gemara and enabled me to master the rabbinic idiom. Nevertheless, if not for my Chabad Melamed, I would today be lacking in an entire dimension of knowledge. Many of my drushos are based upon the knowledge imparted to me by that Malamed. Those who enjoy my drushas owe him a thank you. His name was Rav Baruch Yaakov Reisberg. And I remember that he told me that he was a descendant of the author of the Tanya, the Bala Tanya, the founder of Chabad. I vividly remember how Rav Baruch would teach Tanya. During this period, my father would visit the Chadorim in Chaslovich on either Thursday and Friday. Listen to the story. The Malamed had lookouts who would inform him when the rabbi was on his way. Because remember, this was not the Hasidic Shecheder. This was a Litvisha. This was a Brisker Cheder. This was learning Gemara. So the Malamed, immediately, the volumes of Tanya would be hidden. The Tanya was a small book, and it was easy to hide. We would quickly take out the large Gemaras and shout, as if deeply involved in Talmudic study. Somehow, we always shouted when we studied Gemara. My father would look around and not notice anything out of the ordinary. So the Rav is spending his days, right? So Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, Rav Chaslovich, thinks that the little boys in Chida are learning Gemara. Meanwhile, they're not learning a stitch of Gemara. The Rav actually writes that he's pretty sure that already as a child, he probably knew more Gemara than his Malamed. Right? He said the Malamed probably was not the Tam Tchach, probably was not even so capable of teaching them Gemara. But that's okay. He taught them Tanya. So watch this. Turn the page. When did the secret get out? Listen to this. Once, however, when I accompanied my father to a wedding in Brisk, my grandfather, Reb Chaim, tested me. instead of reciting portions of Merubah, the seventh chapter of Baba Kama, which we were supposedly studying, I recited sections of the Tanya by heart. So now the gig is up, right? Now the Zayda, Rav Chaim Brisker, knows that his little Enoch, Rav Yashaber, does not know a word of Gemara, and worse than that, he's spewing Tanya, right? So they were able to go ahead and fool Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. My father and grandfather may have been angry, but I am in debt to the Melamed. His teachings broadened my horizons in Judaism. The Melamed inspired me with his descriptions of the kingship of God and of the spheros or emanations from the divine presence. The Melamed had studied in the yeshiva in Lubavitch, and his method of speech uplifted and transformed me. At the time, I was too young to truly comprehend many of his teachings. Only later did I understand and appreciate the lessons in their full depth. He taught me how to pray with emotion and ecstasy, and gave me an appreciation for the high holy day prayers. I often think of him on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Do something simple, he would say, but do it with emotion and feeling. That is the basic message of Chabad. Do something mundane and simple, but do it with divine inspiration and meaning. This is the general message of Chassidus, and certainly the touchstone of Chabad. I would like to illustrate the influence Chabad had on me by citing another childhood experience. This too happened in the old Chassidic base medrash, where the Rav, Roshnor Zalman Avliadi, once prayed. There was an alcove in the northern wall where I would find a place on Friday night before the Mincha prayer. Most people congregated at the eastern wall, but something drew me to the northern wall. The Hasidim and Chaslovich were generally very poor. They were peddlers who barely eked out a living going door to door and hamlet to hamlet. They came to shul on Friday evening, still dripping water from the mikvah. I observed their intense devotion as they recited psalms, running up and down the base medrash. They cannot stand still because they were overwhelmed with emotion and inspiration. While observing them, I felt not only that they were reciting psalms and preparations for the prayer, but that the redemption was actually happening at that moment. All their weekday tribulations were behind them, and they were entering a world that was entirely good, a world that shall be altogether Shabbos, with repose and eternal life. As a child, I was convinced that the presence of God rested upon them in their every movement in the Hasidic base medrash. So here you understand. So I hope what I've been able to give you tonight is a little bit of an understanding of the Rav's personality. So if you want to understand, kind of bringing everything together, so if you want to understand how it could be that the same man could be lonely, but yet surrounded by people, the same halachic man who says you could only view reality through constructs of halacha, could also say that you could go ahead and connect with God in a meaningful way, even if you are totally ignorant, as long as what? As long as you're sincere, now we begin to understand it. Because he saw two different models in two different grandfathers, a Rav Eliyahu Prajaner and a Rav Chaim Brisker. Because ultimately he saw that even in the greatest minds of his Soloveitchik family, they had a childlike simplicity when approaching HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He learned from his father the concept of Teiku, which means that as much as we rely on the intellect, we accept the fact that intellect has limitations. He learned from his namesake, the Beis Halevi, that although we pledge our allegiance, our fidelity to Halacha, but Halacha must also always take into account another's feelings, even the feelings of a maid. And ultimately, what we see from the Rav is, despite growing up in the lap of Lithuanian aristocracy, clearly his little exposure to his Chabad Melamed, this man, if you imagine the Gan Eden that this Chabad Melamed had, the way he inspired the Rav, the little bit of Tanya, this lesson that do something simple, but do it with meaning, all of this coalesces in the great personality we call Rav Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik. They're not contradictions. It's just different parts of a complex, beautiful, and holy, multifaceted personality. In Mirat Hashem, we'll continue next week a little bit more with some of the biography as well as some of the Torah. There's 9 o'clock Marav in the base medrash, starting now.
Rabbi, when are we going to talk about Zion?
Next year.
Next week.